All right, thank you. Thanks for the introduction, and well, good afternoon, everybody. So this is joint work with Pierre Mourlan, Christopher Krugel, and Giovanni Vigna from UC Santa Barbara, Gregoire Jacob from Lastline, and Manuel Egele from Boston University. So in this work, we attempt to detect malicious accounts on online services, and I think that everybody in this room is using some sort of online service, whether it is your webmail provider, say Gmail, or some sort of cloud storage or a social network, and so on. And since these services are so popular and, you know, they have 100 millions of users and so on, they started being misused by cyber criminals as well. So over the last few years, we've seen different types of malicious activity on these online services that are carried out through malicious accounts. So we've seen spam, you know, people, cyber criminals create fake accounts on Facebook or Twitter and use them to spread spam. Same happens on blog platforms. We've seen malicious activity on cloud storage, so Dropbox, Google Drive, and so on. And here, cyber criminals, for example, compromise user accounts and steal personal information from users and maybe use it to mount spear phishing attacks or identity theft, and so on. Or they might just create their own accounts and use them to store illegal content, maybe stolen content. And another example are actually computation platforms, so AWS and whatnot. And the cyber criminal can create accounts and use this computation power to mount denial of service attacks against web servers. So as you can see, there is a variety of different types of attacks and malicious activity going on all these services. And this is why, in our community, a number of systems have been presented to fight this malicious activity. So these systems typically go after a quite narrow type of attack. So they try to detect and block one type of attacks on a specific online service. So for example, we've seen papers on forum spam and blog spam that basically try to detect comments based on the modus operandi of attackers on those platforms. And then they try to apply some sort of machine learning system to detect, to distinguish between legitimate and malicious activity. We've seen systems looking at malicious YouTube comments, and these were looking at context-specific and domain-specific features of YouTube, so the possibility of liking and unliking comments and things like that. And then we get to social networks, where probably most of the work has been done, so people have looked at the way in which fake accounts connect to the social graph compared to legitimate accounts, or the way in which fake accounts actually operate on the social network. And there is also some work on webmail accounts. So all these systems work really well to detect malicious, the particular type of malicious activity that we were designed to fight. And that's because they all use some domain-specific element for the specific service and the specific type of activity that they're fighting. So in this paper, actually, we look at malicious activity from a different perspective. So we observe that there are actually elements that are common to malicious activity on all online services. And so our aim is to develop a system that can detect all sorts of malicious accounts on any online service, regardless of what they're actually doing and on the platform on which they're actually operating. So what are these commonalities? Well, if you look at a large-scale cybercrime operation on an online service, it's very likely that this activity has been performed by botnets. So we will have an infected computer somewhere in the world that is instructed by a botmaster to connect to malicious accounts. They could be fake accounts created by the cybercriminal or purchased on the black market, or they could be compromised accounts. So your Facebook account, for example, that has been taken over and is actually used to spread spam. Now, for both performance and resiliency reasons, cybercriminals do not have a single infected computer accessing a single account, but they have actually a variety of them accessing a number of accounts. And the reason for this is that, the performance reason is that infected computers are not that reliable, and so the owner of these computers might shut them down. And if you have a single bot accessing a single account, and suddenly the computer controlling it is not there anymore, you have, as a cybercriminal, an account that is useless. Or also, these computers might be cleaned up by antivirus software and so on. And the dual is also true. So if you have an account that is suddenly detected as malicious by the online service and shut down, you have a bot that is useless. So this is why we observe a set of accounts accessed by the same set of IP addresses or machines, which is a botnet. And this is true for really any online service. So what we can do is actually identify this set of accounts as a community of accounts that are accessed by the same botnet and just base our detection system on that. And this has multiple advantages, if you think about it. The advantages are that basically we are suddenly service agnostic, so we don't care about the domain-specific information on the specific online service that we are looking at. And we are also activity agnostic. So most of the previous systems that I described were looking at spam. So the malicious accounts had to send some sort of malicious message on the online service to be detected. But we don't care about that because we only look at the mapping between accounts and IP addresses. And so suddenly we can detect types of malicious activity that are way broader and that previous work actually overlooked. So for instance, we could detect accounts that are just used to crawl the online service. Think about accounts that are actually, you know, compromised accounts on Facebook that are used to crawl your friends' personal information. We can detect accounts that are used as command and control channels. So there are Twitter accounts that are used to connect to the service, read some information, and use this information as sort of an instruction to perform some other activity out of band. And also, there is this tendency of cyber criminals to use online accounts, such as webmail accounts, as a drop service. So they will basically store stolen information, such as financial data, credit card information, and so on, in the drafts folder of a webmail account, and we will never send an email out. And so systems that look for accounts sending out emails would fail in detecting them. So the first question that we had to answer really is this threat model accurate? So are there, is it true that botnets are a big problem when looking at online accounts? So to answer this question, we looked at a data set that we obtained from a web-based email service. Over a period of one day, we had 72 million emails sent by 21 million accounts. And the problem here, as always in these cases, is to establish ground truth. So to establish ground truth and understand what kind of accounts actually are spammers for sure, we looked at heavy hitters, so at accounts that are sending a lot of spam on the online service. So we looked at basically accounts that sent 10 or more emails during that day and for which the webmail service flagged most of these emails as spam. And we detected 170,000 of these accounts, and the majority of them had actually been accessed by multiple IP addresses, so two or more IP addresses. So we see that the majority of accounts here are actually likely accessed by botnets. Then the straightforward thing you could do here is just saying, okay, if I look at accounts that are accessed by many IPs, I can just flag them as malicious, and then I'm done. Why do you need to detect communities? Well, we try to do that, and it turns out that it doesn't work. So if we look at accounts that are accessed by 10 or more IP addresses during a day, turns out that 32% of them on this webmail service are false positives, so this doesn't really work. And this is why we need this community detection system. So based on these observations, we developed our system called Evil Cohort that goes through four different phases, which I'm gonna describe now in detail. So the first phase is data collection. And the interesting part about our system, as I said, is that we don't need any domain-specific information. And actually, the data we collect is very, very simple. We just need a timestamp, an IP address, and an account identifier. So we collect all this data for one day from any online service, and then we have this mapping between IP addresses and accounts. And from this we can extract basically for each account the set of IP addresses or machines, if you want, that access that account during that day. And when we transform this data into a graph. And our graph is composed as follows. So we have the nodes are actually the accounts, and two nodes are connected if they shared IP addresses, so they were accessed by the same IP address. And the weight of those edges is actually the number of IP addresses that the two accounts shared. So as you can imagine, this graph is very sparse, typically, because most of the accounts do not share any IP address. And then we apply community detection. So we apply the Louvain method, which is a clustering method to detect communities on this graph. And an additional measure that we introduce is a way to basically prune false positives. Of course, if you imagine there are legitimate cases in which two accounts will share the same IP address, for example, if they are behind the net and so on. So the way we can prune false positives is by basically removing edges that have a low weight. And we can tune this threshold, which we call S, to basically tune false positives as low as we want. Of course, the higher the threshold S, the lower the number of accounts that we can detect, because we can only detect accounts that have been accessed by S or more IP addresses. But I will describe these later in the results section. Then we have an optional phase, which allows us to characterize communities. And so here we look at the communities we detect, and we look at the activity of these communities, and we extract interesting properties that allow us to basically infer whether this community is controlled by botnets or by humans. And so some examples are the distribution between IP addresses and user agents, or the time in which these accounts are controlled. As I will show you, regular accounts have show diurnal patterns, so they are very active during the day and not as active during night, while botnets typically show bursts there. So these techniques could actually be used to further prune false positives, but we wanted to keep our system as generic as possible. So for example, the user agent is not necessarily available on any online service, and so we didn't want to introduce these as a critical part of the system. But as I will show you later, this is actually very, very useful to actually assess false positives for our system. So the first thing we needed to do was selecting a threshold S for our experiments. So the way we did that, we basically used the same ground truth that I described before, these 103,000 spam accounts that were accessed by two or more IP addresses. And then we also looked at all the other accounts that were not part of our ground truth, for which we are not so confident that they were actually spammers or not. And then we basically detected communities on this data set, and for each community, we basically would declare it as a true positive if at least 10% of the accounts in that community belong to this very strong ground truth of heavy hitters. And the details about this are in the paper. But so basically, the way we did this, we had in blue the accounts in the ground truth, in yellow, the additional detection that we made that we think are false positives based on this definition. And then we had the smaller circle are actually the false positives, the accounts for which we could not confirm that they were spammers. So with a threshold of 2, we can detect most of the accounts in this data set in the ground truth, 91% of them. With our method, we can increase our knowledge of malicious account by 40%, but the false positives are huge, 9%, which is totally unacceptable. So we can increase the threshold a bit further. We detect only 50% of the accounts in the ground truth, because 5 as a threshold means that we only look at accounts that were accessed by 5 or more IP addresses. We are still able to grow our knowledge by 25%, and false positives are 3%. By increasing it even further, we get to 10, and so we only can detect 16% of the accounts in the ground truth, increase our knowledge by about 8%, and false positives now are 1%. We can increase the threshold as much as we want, so if we get to 65, we finally reach 0 false positives. We can only detect 1% of the accounts in the ground truth and increase our knowledge by a little bit, 84 accounts. And this is interesting because suddenly the online service could just deploy this without any human interaction and not have false positives. But it wouldn't be very interesting for the remaining of my talk talking about these 84 accounts that we detected, right? So for our experiments, we actually decided to set S to 10. So about 1.7% false positives, growing our knowledge by about 8%. So setting this threshold, we wanted to show what basically I claimed before, that our system can work on very different online services and on very different types of malicious activity. So to do this, we first applied our system to a webmail activity dataset, which was basically a dataset that was homogeneous to the one that we used for ground truth, coming from the same service, just collected over a very long period of time, 5 months, instead of a single day. We had 1.2 billion emails, and with our system, we were able to detect 1.2 million malicious accounts. Then we performed the same sort of false positive assessment that I described before. So we extracted very heavy hitter spammers that we consider as ground truth, and these communities needed to have a certain percentage of heavy hitters to be considered as true positives. And actually, we were able to grow our knowledge by 500,000 accounts, which is quite a lot. And for 23,000 of them, we were not able to confirm whether we were false positives or not. So to be on the safe side, we say that our system has about 2% false positives on this data set. And then we looked at a completely different data set. This data set was coming from online social networks, login events, so completely different online service and completely different type of activity. The first data set were email events, so accounts sending emails. These were just logins, so we would be able to detect malicious activity on this service potentially before any malicious activity is even performed. So here we had an 8-day period for 14 million events, and these were four smaller social networks. And on this data set, we were able to detect 1,100,000 malicious accounts. Now, the problem here is that we don't have ground truth for this data set. So how do we assess how well we performed here? Well, we applied the post-processing techniques that I described before to characterize the behavior of these communities. So these communities were 83, and we looked at the IP to user agent distribution, we looked at time properties and so on, and we considered as suspicious or possible false positives any community for which at least one of the post-processing filters didn't look right, so it didn't clearly indicate automated activity. And we found five such communities. And four of them were really, really small, so they were smaller than 8 accounts. And so I'm not going to talk about that. There are details in the paper about why we think that some of them are not false positives, but I don't have time to go into them. But another community was actually huge. It was composed by 5,000 accounts. And so if this was a false positive, it would mean that on this data set, our system would have a 5% false detection rate, which is not acceptable. So we wanted to dig deeper into this. And I will tell you more about this community. So for the rest of my talk, I'll call this community Charlie. And the question is, what is Charlie? Is it a false positive, or is it a true positive of our system? So we looked at the event-based time series. So here we have basically graphs like this. This is for legitimate accounts. On the x-axis, we have time, and on the y-axis, we have activity. In this case, activity is the number of login events on this data set. As you can see, regular accounts show very clear diurnal patterns. So they are very active during the day and not very active during night. This is what happens on pretty much most online services. But when you go to the malicious community, we see something very different. We see these spikes where basically the bot master will give an order and all the accounts will start being active. So what about the Charlie community? Well, it shows something very weird. So we can spot some sort of diurnal patterns, but they are not as clear, but we can also not see clear spikes as in the malicious graph. So we look at another post-processing technique, which is the account usage over time. And here we have basically time on the x-axis, and on the y-axis we have accounts, and we basically plot a dot every time an account is active. And for legitimate accounts, you can once again see diurnal patterns. So the plot is very dark during days and almost white during night because accounts are not active that much. For malicious accounts, we can see very clear synchronization. So we can see that basically accounts are active at the same time because the bot master gives an order and all the accounts start becoming active. For the Charlie community, we see that the two things come together. So we see diurnal patterns, but we also see vertical stripes that indicate automated activity. So basically what we conclude here is that this community is very likely to be composed of compromised accounts, in which basically their legitimate users keep using them, but there is also some additional malicious activity that is blending in with it. So we conclude that this is not actually a false positive, but it's a community that our system correctly detected. It's just that it's not only automated activity. So as a discussion, well, our system is service and activity independent, and this is very important because we can suddenly detect accounts that do not need to perform any malicious activity, any clearly visible malicious activity on the online service to be detected. In fact, on the login dataset, we don't know what kind of activity these accounts were performing. Could have been spam, could have been crawling, could have been something else, but we were able to detect all of them. And so our system detects botnet-like activity, and legitimate accounts are unlikely to form communities. And we showed that in the case they form communities, we can basically use this post-processing information to make sense of them, to see if they're actually false positive or if there is something else going on. Of course, we have some limitations. For instance, we can only detect accounts that are accessed by multiple IP addresses, so we cannot detect, for example, very targeted attacks. But we showed that this sort of access is accounting for the majority of malicious activity on online services. And also, we cannot distinguish between fake and compromised accounts. We could with the post-processing techniques, but these are not automated. And this is important because as an online service, the way you deal with fake accounts and compromised accounts is very different. With fake accounts, you can just delete them. With compromised accounts, you need to contact the user and tell them, you know, your account was compromised, we need to reset your password, and so on and so forth. So this would be something that would be nice to have automatically done in the system. So to conclude, I present a Devil cohort, which is a system that detects malicious communities on online services. And we ran it on two different real-world data sets, showing that basically this system can be applied on very different online services that are performing very different activity. And with this, I conclude, and I'm open to questions.
There we go. So two questions. The first is, for the services that you analyzed, do they actually employ IP blacklists already? And then if they do, could you have just used like a simple threshold instead saying, this IP was accessed by 20 accounts, why don't we block all of them?
So they use some sort of IP blacklist, I believe, but I don't think that IP blacklists are completely accurate. So yeah, we could have used some sort of threshold so were you asking about ground truth or?
Two parts, really. It's, do criminals have an incentive right now to evade IPs and like try to appear disparate across? Mm-hmm. And then if they don't, would it have been simple enough just to have looked at, you know, one cluster of accounts all logged in from this IP? Because you're doing two things, mm-hmm. a bunch of accounts and a bunch of IPs. I just want to know, one IP was used to access a bunch of accounts. Would you have accomplished the exact same thing?
Oh, no. I showed you. We have a section in the paper showing that the false positives there would be way too high. So we basically reduce false positives by more than an order of magnitude by doing the community detection while still keeping similar detection rates.
Okay. Yeah. And the second question I have is, how much of that traffic was composed of like NATs and mobile? Because as you move more towards that, it seems like you're going to have large clusters of users that do mm-hmm. shift a bunch.
Mm-hmm. So, probably quite a high fraction. If you remember when I described how to tune the threshold, most of the accounts would be kicked out when you increase the threshold to 3 or more IP addresses. So there is quite a high fraction of users that are behind nets and so on. But if we set this threshold high enough, say to 4 or 5 IPs, we already discard most of them.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. And hi, I'm just wondering, for the graph is constructed based on the shared IP addresses. Mm-hmm. So is that any guarantee the constructed graph should be connected? I mean, in real world, is that possible? It's not connected. In that case, how is this method workable, or? Have you considered this scenario?
So what we observed is that the graph is very sparse, and these malicious communities tend to cluster all together. Mm-hmm. So most of the accounts, of course, will not be connected to anything because they will not share any IP address, or some of them might share IP addresses but have a very low weight. So we can basically discard these edges with by increasing the threshold.
One more question is, for some other kind of graphs, it has been reported that they don't have such a clear community structure. Mm-hmm. So have you ever seen such kind of scenario? Or?
No, it turns out that since we're looking at accounts that are accessed by botnets, they tend to form communities, and these communities are quite evident. But, I mean, that's because that's our threat model. If we looked at different types of, targeted attacks or attacks that are not as large scale, probably there wouldn't be this clear community structure, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I actually have one more question myself. Now that you've published this paper, and so the bad guys know how mm-hmm. you're detecting their communities, do you think that they could use that knowledge to actually perturbate and escape detection, or are there any fundamental limits to what they can do?
The main problem is that, as I said, they need to be efficient, right? So what they could do is just having an account accessed by a single bot, but then as soon as you detect an account as bad, the bot would be useless, or vice versa. So that's why they have to keep this sort of community structure. Otherwise, you know, they would need to spend a lot more money buying new bots or creating new accounts and so on.
Hi, my name is Nectarios. In the beginning, you talked about the set of accounts that you studied, that there were like a few thousand or hundred thousands mm-hmm. of vetted mm-hmm. spam accounts. Mm-hmm. So they were true positives in the beginning, right? Correct? That's what you mean when you say vetted?
Yes. So we basically used these accounts as a measure for the accuracy of our system. So we had these accounts, and we also had many more accounts for which we didn't know anything, and we wanted to get a feeling of how well our system would work.
And so if there were vetted spam accounts, why did you detect a certain amount of false positives?
Sorry, say it again.
So you said you measured a set of false positives. You had mm-hmm. a set of false positives. So they were not spam accounts, right? Those.
Yes. So we had these vetted spam accounts, and then we had all the other accounts collected during the same day. And so these spam accounts, many of them ended up forming communities with accounts that were not part of our ground truth. We also had a small number of accounts that were not part of this ground truth and were just forming communities with each other. So for those, we are not sure whether they're false positives or not, but to be on the safe side, we consider them as false positives.
And one last thing, how do you measure false positives? What's a false positive?
A false positive in this case would be an account for which we could not prove that it was a malicious account.
And you did this in an automated way?
No, this was just an analysis done after the system had performed, yes.
I just don't understand what criteria you use to identify a false positive.
So these were communities in which the fraction of, basically there were not many accounts in our ground truth in that same community. So if there is a community for which we've never seen any account, we would consider it as a false positive because we wouldn't be sure that it was a malicious community.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.